Future presentation.
Welcome back to another Untitled Movie Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Matt Rohrbeck, alongside, he's allergic to tomatoes, but he is tomato meter approved, Eric Marchin.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, today we are reviewing Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg's The Studio. Mind you, there are a couple other creators. They just directed most of the episode. Peter Hyuk, Alex Gregory, Frida Perez. But every episode is directed by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, which is now playing on Apple TV+. The first two episodes are available for you to stream. Eric and I will be doing a full review. So of the complete first season, maybe complete series, we don't know at this point, of The Studio. We will keep it spoiler free. We might talk about the details of episodes one and two, which are the promotion and the oneer. But anything moving past that from episode three onward, we will keep mostly spoiler free. There's been a lot of promotion and trailers and different things, and you know, there's certain cameos that have been revealed in trailers and fake teasers and all these kind of things. So we might bring up a couple people who are in this series. If you don't want to know anything, maybe back out now, but we won't spoil specific jokes or bits or anything like that. You know, fake movies or anything that might happen later in the season. But yeah, this is going to be a fun one to talk about, Eric. So I love that. And we will be talking about Entourage probably quite a bit. We'll be talking about many other things as well. I've mentioned Curb Your Enthusiasm, obviously. That's one that came to mind.
There's also the Larry Sanders Show, Gary Shandling series that feels kind of, it was based on like a TV talk show, like a late night talk show host, but it had like the feeling of like what's going on currently. And it was just really well written.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like the critical favorite of this. And I think The Studio is going to be that for a lot of people that are in the industry, a lot of people that are adjacent to the industry.
Yeah.
There's a feeling of, though, you know, the term inside baseball comes up a lot when discussing something like this, because you have Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg who have done tons of pitches, who have talked to studio heads and executives and have, you know, seen the inside of what it's like to work in this. And it's almost a little bit like an autopsy at times. And I can only imagine what maybe some of the people that they have interacted with in the past feel about, like, maybe certain characterizations of, you know, like Catherine O'Hara's character kind of being referenced as or compared to
Amy Pascal. Yeah, 100%.
And things like that. And so it's like, you know, I know you really love, you know, the book that Seth Rogen wrote as well, that he kind of talked a little bit about, you know, talking to, like, say, someone like Nick Cage. It almost feels like an extension of this in a way, but still fictionalizing certain aspects of it. Because, you know, the first two episodes of the show, you know, you're introduced to Matt, and Matt is played by
Matt R, baby.
Matt R. Matt Remick is played by Seth Rogen. And that's maybe like the only thing I will say, that is, like, a show like this, you want actors who don't draw too much attention to themselves in the sense of, like, they're not names. Because if they're a name, like if it was like George Clooney as,
sure,
you know, Matt Remick, it would be hard to get over the fact that it's George Clooney. I think Seth Rogen is such a an accessible and knowable commodity when it comes to, like, an actor, a creative, that it is a little bit distracting as well, where it's like, oh, it's Seth Rogen.
He's playing one of those guys where it's hard to remove yourself from the Seth Rogen of it all.
Yes. Not to say that Catherine O'Hara isn't either, because Catherine O'Hara is Catherine O'Hara and she has this amazing legacy. But you look at, like, someone like, you know, Ike Barinholtz, it's like, okay, well, yeah, he's been in some stuff, but he kind of works as, like, that sleazy underling type performer, or that, you know, that character. And that's where, like, the only compliment I will give to Entourage is that, for the most part, that crew were mostly unknowns, with the exception of Kevin Dillon. but even Kevin Dillon was more, you know, in the shadow of his brother, Matt. And so like, you never were like taking any, oh, I knew this person from this movie or this TV show, or they're too well known, where I think like, that's like my only major criticism with the show. And the other slight criticism I have, and we can only maybe talk about it in the sense of episode two, is the Oneer, where we have Sarah Pauly acting again, which is great. The movie she is making, The Silver Lake, does not look like a Sarah Pauly movie whatsoever. And that is something that kind of takes me out of the movie a little bit, because like,
interesting.
I feel as though like these films that we're seeing, movies within the series, aren't necessarily reflective of the people's own filmography.
No,
Peter Berg's movie doesn't feel really like a Peter Berg movie in the moment, not when it's breaking the fourth wall and we're getting back into the studio, but like when we're seeing like a scene play out, it's like, oh, that doesn't really look like, you know,
or even the Spike Jones reference. There's like many other filmmakers.
It's funny. Don't get me wrong. And I love,
is that part of it though? Is that part of the commentary of these people selling out essentially and making these movies that, I'm not saying everyone's a sellout, but like Sarah Pauly's movie definitely doesn't feel like something that's a commercial play per se, but doesn't necessarily feel like one of her movies, but she's given all this, you know, because of Matt wants to kind of make these types of movies, she's given kind of this, I don't know. I understand what you're saying there, but I
feels like the same thing with Entourage though, where like when you saw, you know, the James Cameron Aquaman and like,
sure,
you watch,
but
that,
I think that's
like
also part of it, right? These people don't want to play themselves. They're playing these fake versions of themselves that are a bit more up their own ass, and kind of, as we see with, you know, we'll see with certain filmmakers and actors turned filmmakers, which is a big thing that obviously Rogan being that brings in a lot of those types of people that started as actors and became filmmakers. And you see that kind of as a recurring thing throughout the series. I'll kick it off. I mean, you mentioned Seth Rogen's yearbook. I would say Seth Rogen is one of those guys, one of my favorite people working in Hollywood. I've always kind of vibed with the guy. I think I come from that laid back kind of mentality, but then also someone who obviously genuinely really gives a shit about movies and loves movies, much like this character. I wouldn't say he's 100% this. And Matt is a complicated guy in the sense of likable at times, despicable at others, just a guy who wants, you know, pathetic at times, you know, a very interesting character in the sense of you love him, you hate him, you're everything in between. But I've always loved Rogan for his aesthetic, the kind of projects he picks. I've always vibed with his style, and the things that he's done. So this show is so my shit from everything of sharing, you know, a name and an initial, his name being Matt Remick, which if you say it very quickly, Matt Rohrbeck, like it's just drinking cold brew with oat milk and pitching a Jenga movie. And
you're
all
drinking the Kool-Aid on this show.
I really am, dude. And I was all in from the moment, like moment one of being, you know, both making fun of Oneers, but then shooting the entire series in these long takes, like, you know, another movie that we hadn't mentioned earlier, but Robert Altman's The Player, which they reference by a character name very early in the show. And that's obviously an inspiration too. And, which is a movie that I'm absolutely obsessed with as well. And this show, just from frame one, from the filmic look, whether they shot it on film or did the thing that Severance did where they shot it digitally and then transferred it to 35mm. I'm not 100% sure. I haven't looked into that a lot, but I love the look of it, the aesthetic of it, the long one takes. I think it is one of the funniest shows I've ever watched in my life.
It's also kind of sad.
Yes, but then that's what I love about it. And what Rogan always brings, Rogan and Goldberg, and why I've always loved them, is their comedy, I think, lands more than it misses. I think their aesthetic always is exactly what I'm looking for in something. And I feel like they do bring heart to stuff. And I think if you see throughout the show of that art versus commerce thing, I do think that they kind of understand the studio system, especially in a modern sense of what it is now. And not necessarily in the one for you, one for them mentality, which I know Sarah Pauly brought up in an interview with our friend Rad, and something we've talked about a lot, obviously, with Disney scooping up a lot of, you know, indie filmmakers and Sundance filmmakers and bringing them in to do Marvel movies.
Oh, it's not just
Star
Disney,
Wars
though.
Movies.
And I mean, look at Jared Hess directing a Minecraft movie.
Yeah, I shouldn't just say Disney. I just mean major movie studios,
yes,
right? I think Rogan and Goldberg, you know, they were put in director jail for a little bit because of the interview. Bad circumstances of what with that movie. And This Is the End is fantastic, and they've become kind of more producers and writers than they have been directors, but it's so wonderful to see them return to this. And I think they just have a good grasp on the kind of art versus commerce, like I was mentioning, of picking populist kind of things, but giving them heart and really making sure their quality, and they don't always hit, you know, Point Grey doesn't have a 1,000 batting average. Right.
But like, they produce some interesting stuff. Yeah. Like even Cobweb is an interesting movie for them to produce, you know, it's outside of the box for them.
And that's what I like, is that they, you know, whether it's Ninja Turtles or Cobwebs or Invincible or whatever, like they pick interesting stuff to do. And then also try to kind of know that you have to work with IP sometimes, or you have to not have to, or you find the things that you're interested in to push. And I think all of their experiences that you've mentioned are kind of put into this show, and nothing was off limits to them of their years of talking to studio heads and talking to agents and talking to marketing people. And all of that was thrown into this. And then you take their kind of, you know, what they are like, their aesthetics that they like, and they throw it in here with, if you look at Point Grey, their production company and kind of the aesthetic and vibe of that, I think is transferred almost one-to-one into kind of the filmic look and the title cards and all of that kind of stuff, which I always obsess with. And then you have these long one-ers, and they become these kind of anxiety filled sequences that why people are bringing up Curb Your Enthusiasm or thing. It's this, these people that are kind of like unlikable because they're sort of narcissistic or always just want people to like them, which is opposite of Larry David, but they're put into these situations of like always doing the worst possible thing.
Well, they're their own worst enemy, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not just simply like, you know, they want to be loved, or they think that they're, you know, the best at what they do, or they're on the same, you know, level as anybody else in any other profession. It's also like they're not being true to themselves, and the reason why is because they want to toe the bottom line and stay and have a job, you know, like,
yeah.
The whole point of Seth Rogen's character of Matt at the beginning of episode one, he's talking about like, you know, if I had this opportunity to, you know, lead this studio, Continental Pictures, pardon me, what I would do is I would, you know, greenlight all these art films and all these, you know, great movies and be remembered as being like a Robert Evans or something like that. And, you know, he folds as soon as Bryan Cranston's character says, like, I want you to take over this job.
And do the Kool-Aid movie.
And do the Kool-Aid movie and none of this artsy, fartsy bullshit. And he folds. And he, like, literally, there's a great interview with Rogan, Seth Rogan, talking about this with Howard Stern, where he says, like, you know, there's a lot of people in this industry that have delusions of grandeur where they feel like they're the ones that are going to change the industry or course correct the industry. And they want to be the ones to do it. But then, you know, when it comes from the studio side of things, when they have, you know, the boss is looming over them saying like, well, the bottom line is the bottom dollar, then it's like, okay, yeah, we're greenlighting a Minecraft movie and not, you know, this or that. Obviously, you know, there are ways around it. And the Kool-Aid movie, which is very funny because Greta Gerwig's Barbie looms over this whole series in a way.
He said it changed everything that they did.
Yeah. And you know, he mentioned he was more specific on filmmakers than he was like on studio executives. But studio executives, I think there are a lot of them that have this feeling of like, and I think this is even with politics. I think this is with like any position of power where you think like you're coming from the point of view of an idealist, in that you're coming in and that you're going to be the one to change the game. You're going to be the one that says, hey, I'm going to be the one that works with the creatives, not against them. I'm going to protect them from, you know, the outside forces, and we are going to make the best run of movies we've ever had. And it's going to go back to, you know, the era of cinema that I, you know, grew up loving the most, whether, you know, for a lot of people, and I think for Rogan in particular, is probably like a lot of people his age, is the 70s, right? You know, like mentioning Robert Evans and like The Godfather and things like that. It's like, that's the era of filmmaking that Matt wants. He doesn't want to make, you know, these movies that are just basically cash grabs for the weekend box office that make as much money as possible in order to support, you know, the profits and make sure that they, you know, make as enough as they can so they can greenlight a sequel or they can buy the next IP. Because yeah, we're seeing that even in the real world. And this is where I think like it's almost too depressing at times, where it's like it gets to the point. But I also think there's an aspect of this show that kind of illustrates how lonely a position like this is, or like how lonely a lot of these characters can be, because they either isolate themselves or alienate others, or both. And it comes to the point where you're, you know, you're living on your own, you're by yourself. You know, sometimes that's by choice, but that's and that's fine. But there's a feeling as though like, oh, well, this is your life. You know, this truly is everything you have and everything you want to hold on to.
Or you start to not trust people too, because you think everyone wants something from you, or you have to be the bad guy. And then people, you know, can't separate the business from the personal and stuff like that. But yeah, you know, I just think it from start to finish, I know I've talked to some people who think it lulls a little bit in the middle, and I don't necessarily disagree with that, but that might only be for an episode or two, kind of right in the middle of the season. But for me, I thought it just hit the gas and never let go from the beginning. And I thought it got funnier and funnier. I've never laughed harder in my life than I have at, and I know that's hyperbolic, but at some of these episodes, like I my stomach hurt from laughing so hard. And I think, you know, I think there's an argument to be made that it could be too inside baseball, in the sense of if you are in this bubble of either working in the industry, like I bet you people in Hollywood that work in Hollywood love this show or hate
or
it.
Or they're afraid of it too.
Yes, totally. Or I think if you obsess with this industry, like you work as film critics or film podcasters, where Eric and I are sending, you know, messages and tweets back and forth of this person was cast in this thing, or this director package with Martin Scorsese and The Rock got picked up by 20th Century Studios. And we know what
or
all of
Ketchup
that
just picked up Wile E. Coyote movie,
where most people have no fucking idea any of that shit's happening. And the first time they hear about a movie is when they see a movie trailer during the Super Bowl, or when they go see some one of the four movies they see a year, right? Like most people, that's how they consume film, or they wait and see something pop up on streaming, or they whatever, right? So I do worry a little bit that this might be too inside baseball. However, which you mentioned about Seth Rogen, of him being kind of, you know, a guy who's worked in this industry for a long time, who has made very broad comedies, who is a very recognizable, likable guy, that I think he is that access point of bringing you into that world where, yes, it might seem at times like this guy's not a movie studio head, right? It
would he's be young. Like, that's the one.
He's like someone dropping. It's again, the Matt R of it all. Someone gave me a movie studio and said, run it. And it's just like, you wouldn't fully buy it, right? You'd be like, that doesn't seem like, or any Seth Rogen. It's hard to remove yourself from that. It is like if Seth Rogen ran a movie studio, which he kind of does with Point Grey, even though it's a production company, not a studio,
but he knows enough of the inside sort of like the ins and outs and how things work. And even though
and to make it accessible to people too, I think.
Yeah. Like it doesn't feel false. Even if you don't know what it is, like I still think people can pick up on feeling like, oh, this is artificial, even though it takes place in a very artificial world. You can still pick up on like, oh, this doesn't like ring true to the characters or the storyline, but everything here, you know, to the point of where they're even bringing in certain people that are journalists that are real journalists or podcasters onto the show,
maybe was, some of the weakest performances there, but
I was surprised because it's like they're really taking the chance of being like, okay, we want to make this as authentic.
You could have easily had an actor play that character, right?
Exactly, then, or make up somebody.
Yeah,
because no, they do that as well. Like Brian
that's what
Cranston
I mean by that
is
character.
Made up. So you know, like they could have, but then there's some times where they don't, and they do some things in like. There's one person that comes up that has changed the industry quite a bit. And, you know, the debate between theatrical and streaming is also another thing that comes up a lot on this show, which is also this weird meta commentary.
Because Apple's releasing it. And it's streaming.
I mean,
movies.
The first episode is literally Martin Scorsese talking about, you know, his Jim Jones, Jamestown movie. And like, at one point he just wants the rights back so he can go to Apple with it. Like, you know, like it's like this weird self-referential series.
Because he made Killers of the Flower Moon with them. This is being released on Apple. And then the whole getting him to do the Kool-Aid movie and making it the Jonestown movie, I think is just absolutely. And Scorsese's great in this too.
Oh, like he's amazing, but he's always been a good actor.
Yeah. I mean,
like,
Shark,
he's incredible.
Shark, whatever the Shark World, Shark Tank, whatever that movie's called, Shark Tales. the first two episodes are great. The Warner episode, Sarah Pauly, seeing her act again is fantastic. Obviously, Greta Lee is amazing. And doing that whole episode, whether they, you know, there's also the Seth referential kind of hidden cuts and things that they mention about Warners. And all of this stuff is for the people who obsess over this shit. And they're kind of making fun of you, but then also going, we appreciate that you give a shit about this stuff and love this stuff. And then that's what I like that the show does, is that it kind of makes fun of everything while still celebrating it all as well. And then that's what I mean by the comedy being very broad, in a sense of makes it accessible. And even if you don't know all of the inside baseball terms or who that person is or whatever, that stuff is additive to the people who will really love this show, I think, because of that stuff, like me or you or whoever. But then my mom will watch this and she's not really going to know, you know, certain people or certain,
but you'll know
terms,
who Ron Howard is.
Yes, absolutely. And that will land, right? But then she might not know who the director of Smile is, or, you know, even Sarah Pauly, maybe she's heard that name and she's, you know, whatever, but she wouldn't necessarily be able to connect.
Or like when Greta Lee makes the joke about A24 not being able to fly their talent, you know, like first class, which I thought was very funny, but it's also like, that is something where it's like, okay, like, how many people outside of, you know, the obsessives know like what these studios are and like what the kinds of movies they make?
I think that's okay, because then it just feels like filmy dialogue. And then to the people who get it, we'll laugh at that. It's not the funniest joke in the world, but some of that inside baseball stuff, you're like, oh fuck. Like there, you mentioned someone who pops up and like most people aren't going to even know that that person is that person. Right. And stuff like that. But and there's many, I could be referring to many, many people. And then the other thing I wanted to mention too, of why I love it, is like, I think this also does what The After Party was trying to do really well, which I love Phil Lord and Chris Miller. I think The After Party is a very, very fun show that kind of ran out of steam in its second season, but.
Well, it was supposed to be a movie too, originally. Yeah. Right? And it was reconstructed as a first season, and they didn't even think initially that it would continue.
And again, Apple TV, there's a lot of connections there, and it's doing that thing where there's a meta nature to it, which a lot of Phil Lord and Chris Miller's stuff has, where...
And Ike Barinholtz too, right?
Yeah, that's a great point too. So where each episode is playing off of a genre of film that you're seeing. And this show does that, I think, in a really interesting way as well, where it's not every single episode, but a lot of the episodes, the meta narrative mimics what movie they're kind of talking about in that episode, right?
Or the technique that they're talking about. Because like the Warner episode, I kind of feel at this point that one takes are becoming, they're losing their meaning in film. Like everybody just does them for the sake
and
of,
isn't that what that episode is kind of,
that's the point of it, and that's what I love about it.
But then the show is all Warners.
Yeah, and that's amazing. And but what it's commentating on is basically is that, okay, like the one take has become like the close-up, where when you use it in a movie, it's meant to signify something. You're being immersed in a world. You're getting an emotion out of a character in a key scene. But the more that people use it, and the more that it's just constantly used and you're bombarded with it, it becomes, you know, an exercise point to the, you know, and it loses any, you know, reverence. And so with this, it's making fun of that, but still using it in a way that almost like, you know, you're watching it, you're realizing it as it's happening. And then you're thinking to yourself, oh, can they stick the landing with this? And they do. Yeah. And you're just like, okay, well, that was really clever in terms of like being a self-contained episode of the show that takes the style. And I think this is going to be a really great, you know, series for film students and teachers to show their kids, like, you know, like for first years, where it's like, okay, this is what a one-er is, or this is what a one take is.
Yeah.
Let's watch this, because a visual example of it, I think, is more helpful than, say, a textbook example. And if you can communicate that with a younger generation and say like, oh, hey, like this is, you know, this
gives a modern example too. You don't have to show everyone the beginning of Touch of Evil for the 400th time, right?
So exactly. Like, it just feels fresh. I mean, the only thing that goes against that a little bit is like, I wonder how this show will be, not in terms of even its comedy, but I mean, all comedy does have a shelf life as well. But I do wonder like how this will play, say, 10 years from now.
Will it be dated like Entourage?
Well, not in the regressive.
Yes, I don't mean it in that way. No, I just mean in its references.
But like Seth Rogen, like you look at Judd Apatow movies, like
sure.
When Knocked Up came out, it was being released like right around the same time. This was back in 2007, right around the same time that the third Spider-Man movie's coming out, and they all reference having seen or not having seen Spider-Man 3. And so you look at that now, and it doesn't really mean anything, but it feels weird that it's like it's contemporary.
I think something can be of its time, right?
Like sure. And The Player is that. I think The Player is that as well. But there is always that interesting aspect of like, oh, I wonder, will this kind of feel either like a time capsule of the moment now, or will this be something that's clearly like just, you know, played well when it was released, and then like when you tell other people about, oh, I love that show when it was on, it's like you had to be there though, you know, like
I think more of a time capsule thing, right, where it'll give you a picture, no pun intended, into what the studio system was at that point in time, right? Like it's a very modern show. It does celebrate movies and film in general, to your point of referencing everything going back from the 60s, 70s, 50s, even there's a noir episode. There's, you know, it kind of goes through the gambit of all different types of movies and modern things about movies of, you know, I can't wait for people to see the rest of the episodes. And again, there are things me and you talk about all the time, right? And I think that's why it lands with our bubble of people. But again, Nevis, I guess she's not a great example. We watched these first couple episodes together and I watched them again, and she worked at TIFF, so that's maybe, you know, she's very entrenched in this world where I'd be curious with my mom. I've suggested this with my mom, and she's always my barometer to the normies, right? Like I love my mother, and she loves the
Michael Fassbender in The Killer right now.
She loves
normies.
She loves movies and she loves TV, and she's, you know, but she doesn't have any of that inside baseball knowledge of it, right? So I'm curious with I think it'll still really work for her, and she will understand a lot of it. But then there are even like Catherine Hahn's marketing, Maya Mason, and like her, the marketing woman. She is incredible. And if you've worked in marketing, or if I'm sure people who've worked in film marketing, it's just like, there's so much that it just absolutely fucking nails. And I think Ike Barinholtz is the best thing I've ever seen him in. Like it's the most I've ever liked him. And I've always liked him. Catherine O'Hara is amazing. Chase Sui Wonders is great as well, and I didn't really know of her very much before this.
She was in Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. That was like the only other thing I remembered her from.
And then, yeah, the cameos, which I don't want to spoil all of them if you haven't watched the trailers. Like, obviously, Scorsese in the first episode is amazing. Sarah Paulson and Greta Lee are great in that Wonder episode. And we've seen, you know, they did a Super Bowl commercial with Johnny Knoxville and Josh Hutcherson for a fake Spike Jonze movie called that was the Spike Jonze one, the Apocalypse, right? Yeah. And our first Spike Jonze movie in over a decade. He does an Apple TV.
But there is a connection to that because Spike Jonze was a part of the Jackass crew. Likely he helped kind of get
absolutely.
Jackass together. So that's probably why, like,
with the Johnny Knoxville thing and even the connection, his most recent film you can watch is an AirPods commercial, right? So like there's the connection with Apple too, right? So it's fun seeing stuff like that. And I won't, you know, we've seen little clips of, you know, Zoe Kravitz is in the series, and, you know, there's the intro with Paul Dano and with the Peter Berg movie and Olivia Wilde. And I already mentioned all these other
Ron actors. Howard is my favorite.
Ron Howard. And this is that trend. The Ron Howard stuff is amazing. And the most I've liked Anthony Mackie in a long time too, right? Like bringing these actors turned directors, I think, was a intentional choice from Rogan, wanting to showcase a lot of, you know, directors who could act and or started in acting. And I think that plays really, really well throughout the rest of the show. And I think that through line of the Kool-Aid movie is very funny, and it's
real too. Like I think in a post Barbie world, we're seeing, you know, all this IP being bought up by studios and not necessarily thinking about, oh, could this work as a narrative? But because that movie made so much money and became a critical success and got Oscar nominations, it's like, okay, well, we got to grab as much as we can. And yeah, maybe Kool-Aid is not going to be adapted as a film, but we've gotten an Angry Birds movie, you know? So it's not
two of them.
Yeah. So this stuff is real.
But then that's why I think it works so well in the show, because it feels believable. And like them doing a Kool-Aid movie that tries to kind of mimic what Barbie did of both trying to have something to say. And yes, it goes too far with the Scorsese stuff, but is just perfect. And then kind of how it evolves throughout the series, I think, is a fun thing to kind of watch. But it goes into a bunch of inside baseball stuff of CinemaCon and Comic-Con and giving notes and lengths of movies and
Golden Globes. I think Golden Globes episode, without getting into any of it, it kind of that's where you start to see the loneliness kind of creep in. It's like, oh, this is all you have. And even that is kind of quote unquote a thankless job, you know,
no pun intended.
And so
or pun very much intended,
you know.
And Rogan's talked about that too, of how that came from a real story.
Yeah, and it's really entertaining. Like, it's just funny watching. Like, you don't hate Matt Remick, but you do kind of feel at times, like you were saying before, you know, he basically puts his foot in his mouth, and he's just one of those guys that seems to self-sabotage and debase himself on every opportunity he gets, even though he's not trying to, but he gets in his own way. You know, it's very entertaining to watch Seth Rogen's character just completely destroy himself.
Yeah. And he's not a bad guy, but it is
but he's still a human being.
Exactly. And he's a guy who clearly cares, but to his detriment most of the time, where he almost cares too much about what people think of him and what, you know, what
or he thinks
makes,
he's doing a good thing and he's doing the opposite of that. Like,
exactly.
You know, being there and watching, you know, the scene unfold, it's like, well, you don't, like, I get it from being a movie fan, but now you're, you know, making this, and maybe your presence there is actually causing more problems. And the more problems, it leads to, you know, more money and more time being spent and fixing things. And so you're creating conflict instead of getting through the day and letting the filmmaker make the movie and, you know, spend the time that they need.
It's a bit of a narcissist, not a, like,
oh, definitely.
Yeah.
But I think that's what Hollywood is, right? Like, I think
it's filled,
like,
with narcissists.
There's even like a part of, like, you know, this is nowhere near, you know, this is just like a small little podcast, but know, like even us doing this, there's narcissism in us. It's like, oh, we have the delusion of thinking there's enough people out there that might listen to this or listen to us talk about this because they're coming here to listen to us, not for what we're talking about. Or they could go to 100 other places to listen to reviews of the studio. So I think in every aspect of filmmaking to, you know,
oh, that's why
journalism
we're on.
There is that, but it's also like this weird, like, you basically are a sadist, you know, like you're just are doing this for the sake of just destroying yourself, a masochist, you know, like, and I kind of feel like that's what this is as well. Like they're putting, like Seth Rogen's putting himself out there and often he just falls completely flat, you know, and like there's times where it happens and you're just like, this is great cringe comedy. It's very funny when he intentionally does something to cause a problem or a conflict and it gets out of line or it escalates in a way where, you know, any grown-up would have either walked away or listened to the other person's advice or not spent money on certain things. And, you know, he's going back to like the whole thing of like, well, I'm coming from this as a film fan first. And it's like, well, are you? Because, you know, you're saying that, but you're not actually, you know, sticking your neck out to make the Martin Scorsese film. You know, you're basically a coward.
No, absolutely. And it makes for very uncomfortable, but very, very funny situations. There's another great episode that takes place at like a children's hospital charity dinner. And like, it's fantastic. And we've all had these conversations of people who work in the arts or work in, you know, movies. And again, mind you, Eric and I have this we love movies and we talk about them, but again, I guess your brother works in it. I work in it a little bit, but just the value of the work as well, I think is an interesting conversation in that episode. And I've had those conversations of like, we've all said, oh, we're not saving lives and blah, 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 blah. And I think it comes out in a very funny way. And the pretentiousness on both sides, I think, is very funny in those situations of people who look down on people who maybe work in the arts, of their work isn't important or not stressful because of it. But then on the other side, kind of acting like it is super important. There's a fine line there and a balance in between importance and value in your work and all this kind of stuff and not looking down on others. So you understand why you would be annoyed at these doctors who are looking down on you because you just make movies. But then you're like, okay, well, what you are doing is very important. That doesn't mean you're not an asshole about this and stuff like that. And there's very funny situations and there's a million more, throughout the series and everything feels both. Again, if you are entrenched in this industry and really obsess over it, there's going to be a bazillion things in there for you. I think if you're a more casual movie fan, I still think that there is enough in here that you will really, really enjoy it. And if anything, it might make you more interested in the film industry. And from everything we've heard from interviews and stuff like that, a lot of these stories came straight from experiences that Rogan or Goldberg had. And
well, the Jenga thing was interesting. I don't know if you saw him talking about Jenga.
Dude, I had a Jenga pitch for longest
Die Hard.
Time.
I know.
Dude, yeah. I've told
but
you
I thought
this
about you when Rogan was talking about that, because he talked about that and he talked about Evan Goldberg and him meeting Ridley Scott for a pitch for the Monopoly movie, which Ridley Scott was going to
I remember
after Body
reading
of Lies.
About that on Slash Film, like, you know, 15 years ago when Ridley Scott announced to direct the Monopoly movie or whatever, right? Like, I remember that shit.
But Jenga's Die Hard would have been great.
So that, dude, that's very early in the series, in the first episode, right? Like, that's like right away. Yeah. And from that moment, there's a couple moments when I was watching this, when you almost think you're in a simulation sometimes, where something feels like it's written for you or about you, even though it's not. Obviously, it's just shared experience and obviously similar senses of humor and thinking about similar things, right? But having here's the narcissism of it all, to make it about me. Being like Matt Remick, Matt R., the cold brew thing that I know you laughed at, where
that was amazing. I just thought about that, and this isn't a spoiler, but
it's in the Wonder episode, right?
Yeah, it's Matt, episode two.
Where Matt orders, he's like, "Oh, can you get me a cold brew with oat milk and a splash or whatever?" And I was like, "Oh my god, that's my exact order that I get at Starbucks every time I go, or a coffee shop." So that made me laugh. And everyone's like, "Well, tons of people drink cold brew and oat milk," or it's making fun of people who drink cold brew and oat milk who are like Matt. And then the Jenga thing at the very beginning of the series, those were the two things where it just, you know, triggered this thing in my head of going, "This is too." It's funny because it's coincidental.
But it's like, but it was made for you.
Yes. And even the aesthetics and everything. And it goes, "Well, Matt, you just like Rogan's aesthetics. You really liked the look of his production company, as well as his book and his house plant and his other company, his weed company that he has and stuff like that. So maybe I've taken some of that aesthetic because I like it, or it's just, we have a similar sense of style."
Well, even the boys, right? Like he's a and creative force.
Invincible, dude. Yeah, Invincible, like, yeah. Invincible's like Ninja Turtles.
I think
like
you two would have a good hang.
Oh, I 100% agree with that. He's one guy that I would love to do a podcast with. Like, I don't like interviewing people much anymore, but if I had a chance, and unfortunately for this series, we didn't, if it gets a season two, I will push hard for that. I would love, and I've talked to him once for this is the end.
Yeah.
Although I was very early in my career and kind of got, shouldered out of that round table, and I'll talk to you. You already know that story probably.
I do.
And which was unfortunate, but it was still cool to be there. I was quoted on that poster again, making it about me. The Jenga thing, right away, I've talked to you for years. I'm like, I have a Jenga pitch, and I'm sure it's just similar, you know, people who like kind of taking IP and using it in both a comedic way and a sincere way, which I think is Seth
Battleship, right? Like, that's like one movie that actually made it through.
Exactly. So Jenga, I'm like,
which has Peter Berg directing it.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's probably, you know, a meta joke in that first episode. But having them make fun of the Jenga movie pitch, whether he's actually heard that, because I'm sure there are other writers in Hollywood that have a similar sense of humor as me, or a similar idea. Because a Jenga movie where the floors blow up one thing at a time when a terrorist is taking over the building, it's essentially just Die Hard, but you call it Jenga, and you have, you know, a villain blow up one floor at a time until the building collapses, is perfect. And like, it's
Jenga McClane.
It's perfect. And I'm sure other people have had that idea, and that's where that joke comes from. But for having a show share the same name as you, have the same last initial that sort of sounds like your last name, the
same coffee
runs a movie studio, which is like, you know, I've always talked to you that I'd not necessarily run a movie studio, but I'd love to
movie theater
or something like that, and have the same coffee order, have this Jenga thing in the first moment. The aesthetics are all the same aesthetics I've stolen on every piece of thing that I've made, which is very, you know, that filmic old Tarantino look kind of thing that from the 70s and 60s, and
it's got a psychedelic style to it.
Yeah. And so I all that kind of stuff. So I very much made this whole thing about me, just like that character. So it very much felt like it was written. And
sometimes you get like those things that feel like, "Oh, okay, this truly is geared towards me," or this person that, like, Seth Rogen's older than you, but it feels like his sensibilities are quite similar in terms of, you know, his own interests, both, like, you know, as a filmmaker, as someone who's always also been an advocate for marijuana, like all of this kind of stuff. You know, you have a nicer laugh, but, like, you know,
I love his laugh.
I do too. I do too. I do too. I love Seth Rogen. I really do. And
his book is great, dude. It's like, and yeah, I agree that it's just someone you always, like, when people ask, like, who's your favorite actor, I don't usually have an answer, but Seth Rogen's one of those guys who's always, even from Superbad was a seminal film in my teenage years as well, right? And like, so from the beginning of his career, you know, Freaks and Geeks, I came very late to, but
It was gonna be like, you were the true diehard fan. You knew it when you saw Donnie Darko and he was one of the kids.
I do remember that.
For me, like, I think what Seth Rogen, and maybe like he knows it and he's fine with it, but he's a really good supporting player in movies. And like, this is an ensemble show, so it's not always about him, which is like, it goes against what we were talking about. Like, it actually takes time to explore other characters and storylines,
not
as
just
well.
Matt, it's, there's, you know, all the other characters you mentioned.
I mean, he's a focal point, obviously, but what I love about, like, we're talking about Sarah Polley, the reason why Sarah Polley's in this episode is because Sarah Polley directed Take This Waltz with Michelle Williams and him. That is, in my opinion, his best performance, and there's an amazing, heartbreaking payoff in the final scene between Michelle Williams and his character, because he's playing the chef who's working on this chicken cookbook and making chickens all these different ways. And he does this thing where, I'm going to spoil this, so if you don't want Take This Waltz to be spoiled, he does this thing where, like, every time Michelle Williams' character goes for a shower, he takes like a small, like, bucket of water and pours it over top. And when they're breaking up, he reveals that he was going to one day, when they were older, reveal that it was him doing that the whole time and it wasn't a problem with the shower. And when he does that reveal, like, I think it's some of his best acting of his entire career. But then he's great against Michael Fassbender and Steve Jobs. He's really lovely in 50-50, you know, like he's really good in these roles. And I mean,
even
I love
Fableman's him. Like,
yeah, well, he's great in that. But even like, you know, I think like for a lot of people, probably the breakout role was the 40-year-old virgin.
Yeah.
You know, and then Knocked Up, he's the lead. And from there, it kind of was like, oh, he keeps coming up. And like, even in the small role he has in Step Brothers, when he's doing the job interview with John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell in tuxedos in the gym locker room, like, it's.
Oh, shit. Yeah. No. And even in Anchorman, where he's the cinematographer.
The cameraman. Yeah.
It's great. And he's always been one of my favorite people working. So like, this show just felt. It doesn't happen often when you become like, I was obsessed with this while watching it. I think it was one of my favorite first seasons of a television show that I've ever seen. It was one of my favorite complete packages that I've ever seen. And I know that all sounds very hyperbolic, but if you have similar tastes to me, I really feel like you will feel the same way. And
this is catnip for you.
It is. It really like was every interest I have, minus at least in this industry, right? Yeah, it doesn't go into some of the other nerdy, geeky stuff that I kind of like. It's more focused on film, but that art versus commerce. And that's something I've always talked about, even doing this show with you, right? Like, and why I think me and you balance out to, you know, and have a good podcast, I think, is because of that, you know, not necessarily art versus commerce, but like the populist versus, you know, it just that mix of movies in general, right? Big movies, small movies, art house movies, blockbusters.
Well,
you know,
entertainment as a currency.
Entertainment, right? Yeah. And all of that is something that I, and why I love movies is because I love big IP-based movies, and I love small indie movies, and I like Oscar bait movies, and I hate some of all of those three as well, right? So yeah.
And you think you're going to be the one, if you were the guy leading the charge.
Oh yeah,
I think that's exactly the other thing. It's like, if I were in Matt's shoes, I would have done things differently. But then it's like, well, would you have done things differently? Because you can say that from the perspective of being an outsider.
Exactly.
But if you're doing it there, in the moment, you are literally going to kiss the feet that have given you this job. And you're going
to try to sneakily do the thing that you want. But then you're going to have to cater to all these people that don't really want the best four movies. They just want money.
Money.
To make money, right? And that's the fun, like, even hearing Rogan talk about in the interviews being like, it is a miracle anything good comes from Hollywood.
Well, just even is anything like, getting made, like, yeah, in general, yeah, like, it's so. Almost like making a movie is an accident, you know?
Yeah.
Like, even if it's good or bad, it's one of those things where it's like scheduling, budgets, timing, you know, all of these things.
But especially good though, I think too, to their point of being like, there's so many people that are involved in these things and so many things that these movies have to, do, whether you needed to make money, but you also wanted to be critically good. You also, like, there's so many
screenings.
Yeah, like factors and stuff like that that play into the end product you get, that it is a miracle that anything really good, truly great comes out of it.
Or singular, like something that feels like it comes from one person, because like that's the thing I've always liked about Alex Garland. Is that he always talks about, like, even though it's, you know, his name on the poster because he's the director, he wouldn't be able to make the movie he did without the people he's working with. And I feel like Seth Rogen, even though, like, he's making fun of himself and it's a show about a narcissist, I think, like, it's also showing you, like, look at both, you know, as bureaucracy and trying to, like, jump through hoops and all of this kind of stuff, but look how much it takes to make this, and like, look where we are now as an industry. And when I say we, I mean them, because, like, you know, there's one person in this show that I was so surprised that's not only on it, because it's an Apple based show,
mm-hmm.
but
that's who I was talking about earlier,
but also because it doesn't make them look good.
No,
you know, and there's a couple people where it's like, I don't know what the conversations were, the meetings were like.
I think some of them know, dude. Like, they kind of know what Matt's talking about throughout this thing of, like...
But to make themselves look bad, I think, is interesting.
I don't even know if they think it makes them look bad, or in the sense of they know the people in the industry know the role that they have and what they have to do, much like what we're talking about.
Do you know who I'm talking about, though?
I think so.
It's the Golden Globes episode.
Yes, that's exactly who I'm talking about. Yeah. And that's who I was referencing earlier as well. And I think that will be very surprising. Here's the thing. Most people won't know
that's really him.
Yeah, I know.
Or who that is, even.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's funny that it's on Apple, too, which I'd like, that is mind-blowing.
Exactly. And him to be, you know, to understand the assignment and do that. And we're being very cryptic, but you'll get there. And if you have the inside baseball knowledge of it all,
or if you've, like, seen the episodes and you're listening to us, you know what we're talking about.
And it doesn't make him look great. But then I think, to the point of what the character of Matt in this whole show and what Rogan's saying is, like, sometimes if you want to, you have to play the game, which means you sort of have to sell your soul, which means you have to appease to all these people, and you have to kind of, like, you're still at the head of a company, so you have to greenlight certain projects or make certain movies because it's, you know, but you really want to do this other thing, but you know you have to do this other thing. So it's
you're selling your soul to the devil, and the devil is commerce, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, it's basically what Brady Corbet was talking about with the brutalist. I mean, you could look at it like that as well, right? You know, it's like, you have to, in order to get anything made or get the vision that you want, you have to, it's, you know, like, I'm all about compromising and cooperation and collaboration.
A middle ground, right?
But, yeah, but there is, like, that feeling of, like, okay, like the Kool-Aid episode, this first episode perfectly says, it's like, you know, you are not only, you know, selling yourself short, you are destroying the things and the people you love. Like, you know, to be a Martin Scorsese fan and to basically destroy his film, and in this scenario, it being his quote unquote last movie. But Martin Scorsese is in his early 80s, so he only probably has, and I hate saying this because I want him to make movies forever, but, you know, how many movies does he have left in him? And so, like, in this world, you know, this Kool-Aid movie being one of them, it's like, yeah, it's like, can you imagine, like, having this film ready to go and you be the one that destroys Scorsese's vision? Like, and you just also be, like, a huge fan of his?
Yeah, that must have happened, like, for, like, and maybe multiple times that we don't know about, like, someone.
Oh, there's always
intentionally burying it because of whatever reason, right?
Because, like, there's another movie that has a reference to something, or there's product placement that they don't want it to look bad in another, because there's another movie, and
that stuff's fascinating. Yeah,
yeah. It's all about, like, it's like politics, basically. You know, like, it's all about strategizing and double crossing and. You know, this is an industry that isn't really based on friendships or, you know, camaraderie. It's about, like, at least in the side of, like, agents and studio execs and, you know, people that are CEOs, it's very cutthroat. And, you know, like, it turns you into, like, this paranoid asshole type figure. And I wonder where
that even happens in the film critic world too.
So. It does. It does. But I wonder where, like, it, okay, like if they continue the series or however long they, cause I'm sure.
Do you think it's one and done, or do you think they bring it back?
Well, I think if it's one and done, that's great. But I also do think that Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg probably, like, if they probably have like a map. Like, probably not everything is like perfectly thought out, but they probably have an idea of like, okay, if they want to continue this, maybe they make it two or three seasons.
Yeah.
Because obviously, like, they both want to do other stuff and they're running their own, you know, label and
yeah,
and
I hope this brings them back to do a movie too, right? Like,
they will. They will. I'm sure they just wanted to get this out of them and probably they maybe even thought about doing this as a movie at one point, but maybe that's also
the budget with that Apple, like,
film on television.
It really is. It's film on television and on a streamer, which I think is fascinating in itself.
Which is a conversation then, that this show has about, like, even, you know, film versus shooting digitally and, you know, like, trying to preserve something that is now, you know, going extinct.
A dead format almost.
Yeah. And again, mentioning people that look maybe not great in the episodes that they're in, like Olivia Wilde's another person.
Yeah.
I wonder what that conversation was
like. I think people are fine taking the piss out of themselves.
Oh, I do too. I do too. But sometimes you wonder, like, are they aware of it? Like, some people are self-aware of it or self-aware, but I do think that there are some people that maybe aren't.
Yeah. And I think the fascinating thing, you know, I think Apple TV's on a roll right now. I think they have a lot of, not to, you know, I think with Severance going into this, and obviously they had a lot of success with Ted Lasso. I think Shrinking is excellent. Like, Harrison Ford is fantastic in that. And Jason Segel, talking about another guy that comes from that kind of Apatow.
The undeclared Freaks and Geeks.
Having, you know, they're just scooping up all the Freaks and Geeks. Maybe
Jay Baruchel's new show's coming up.
Hey, I'd be cool with that. And I just like that. You know, there's all this commentary being like, well, they're losing $1 billion per year on streaming. And people are like, yeah, who cares? They make
also, they can afford that.
They can afford it.
It's not their main revenue source.
I think when we've talked about the streaming wars and things like that, and Netflix has kind of rebounded really, really well. But Apple and Amazon, I think, can afford to lose money on their TV and movies because they make so much money in other places. So
I mean, that's why, like, Citadel exists.
Shouldn't we be happy that they're blowing a ton of money on art, right? Like, it's just like, they don't need to make money off of this. Sure, they want to, but like, I think it's more clout based than money based, where it's just like, you bring in interesting, you know, people to work with you, and then it helps you in other ways where you don't necessarily have to have, you don't have to be in the green in your film division at those two companies. Would they like to be? Sure. But I feel like we should be okay with them not realizing, like, it's not okay to be losing money on their stuff. It's, to me, it's like, let them blow a shit ton of money on this stuff because they make money in other places. And if this gets Scorsese to make a movie at the budget he wants, or Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, who maybe wanted to make this as a movie, but Apple's the one who gave them a shit ton of money to do these oneers and all these different things they wanted to do on this show and bring in all these people. Like, if these places are going to give people the budgets to do it, yes, there's a whole conversation that they even have in this show, and we could go on forever about that. But, and that whole conversation is interesting in those last couple episodes, but, anyways, I'm rambling, but
well, just also wanted to say, because it is interesting with the conversation, specifically not with television, but with film, when it comes to like a streamer distributing something, because Netflix has been the one where it does seem like a lot of creatives right now are frustrated with Netflix in terms of not giving the movie a theatrical release outside of a festival run or 2 weeks at a theater that will run a Netflix movie. You know, sometimes Landmark Cinemas in Whippy, for example, plays a Netflix film a couple weeks before it's on available to stream. And that's a conversation where, like, I can see, like, film people talking about it. It's like, well, if, you know, this filmmaker gets the money that they want you know, Apple's in this weird place right now where it's like they're still going theatrical. Like F1 is coming up this summer. You know, Blitz was released theatrically, but they kind of, you know, Wolves quality aside, they kind of pivoted on that one a little bit. So, but when you take a big name filmmaker like a Martin Scorsese or, you know, Alfonso Cuarón or someone like that, and, you know, they get the budgets that they want and the creative freedom that they want and the director's cut and stuff like that. There's a feeling, though, of like, oh, does this movie even count in their filmography because it's not getting a real release and it's being put on to, you know, this streaming service to kind of disappear and die, and not all of these movies get, you know, a Criterion Blu-ray or 4K release, you know, down the line. And like David Fincher's career right now is really fascinating with yeah. that, because he's kind of become the Netflix guy, the spokesman for Netflix,
doing a Squid Game, you know.
Yeah, and but with The Killer though as well, and yeah, and Mank, and like you look at that and you're just kind of like, oh well, we really haven't had a traditional theatrical David Fincher movie since Gone Girl? And yeah, that's 2014, right? And like the French, you know, like Cannes every year, this is the whole thing with them where it's like they don't allow any Netflix movie to play in competition because they don't go the traditional route. And so like, I'm not saying that those movies aren't movies. They are movies, but there is the feeling of, though, is it ephemeral or dispensable, or do they have the same cultural impact that they would if they played theatrically? And obviously theatrical now is there's a conversation about the theatrical window of a movie and how long a film is being released. And, you know, like our audience is now conditioned to the point where, you know, if they have a streaming service that they have a fixed rate that they're paying for, that they'll just wait until Snow White, for example, because I know Snow White, you know, there's been controversy about things that Rachel Zegler and Gal Gadot have said about Palestine and Israel. I'm not trying to get into that whole can of worms, but I think part of what the reason why that movie isn't doing as well is not necessarily because of the politics of the actors, but it's because people that have Disney Plus have caught on to it now that's going to be available to stream in a couple of months.
Yeah.
And I think the remake aspect of it too, for
I think people are getting a little tired of that stuff. I think but we just saw Little Mermaid do, I mean, the weekends were similar, but it still made a shit ton of money. Right. And like Inside Out 2, very different, but Pixar movies, we thought the same thing about it. Right. So I feel like, I don't know, Hollywood, it's a weird thing where I think we analyze specific movies and weekends and box office and stuff like that, or what people are going to see. But I think it's just on a movie by movie basis. And another thing to bring it full circle that Rogan talks about in that Howard Stern interview is like, one movie can change everything, right? One weekend can change everything. And like, yeah, people might not have gone to see Snow White, but they made Inside Out 2 the highest grossing animated movie of all time by going to the theaters, right? So it's like movies are dead one week and then alive the next. And it's like, it just really depends on what the movie is. And if it kind of, sometimes it's a toss up if it will connect with, you know, audiences and if they want to go see it in a theater versus waiting for streaming. Like Inside Out, you feel like that could have been a movie people waited for streaming because we had the pattern of Pixar movies kind of getting a little bit slower and slower at the box office. And then the same thing with these live action remakes. I think, you know, the novelty of them, I think even subconsciously, has kind of worn thin on a mass audience. Like I know even for me, a huge Disney fan, like since I was a kid, I still go to the parks. I've mentioned this all the time. Like I really like the brand and the movies that they put out for the most part. The live action remakes just don't have the energy for anymore. Right. Like I'm fine with remakes. I'm fine with, sequels and all that kind of stuff. But I just feel like you need an interesting avenue into them and just doing these kind of shot for shot remakes. And I've heard the Snow White movie isn't necessarily exactly one-to-one. Have you seen it yet?
No, I haven't, but even going into something like, okay, for example, you know,
we're way off topic now. Everyone go watch the studio.
I know, but
we're now talking about the industry, which is the inside baseball.
Like this will generate
for sure.
Because look at Black Bag, right? Like Black Bag, like today they announced that or Mickey 17, like it didn't do well. And it's going to be released on digital. I was even thinking the other day, it's like, okay, well, if I miss this movie or that movie, I can just catch up with it in a couple of months. I normally don't think that way.
I've started to think that way, dude. And like,
well, that's what I'm bringing up. That's where I feel like audiences are starting to become more aware of these things.
Especially if the hardcore people, I'm pointing at me and you, the people who the studio is for, the inside baseball, the hardcore, go to the cinemas every week kind of people. If I'm at the point now going,
Novocaine.
Exact movie I was going to bring up of being like, I could go out and see Novocaine, or I could wait and see Novocaine in a couple weeks on streaming. And like, it's not necessarily, unfortunately, it doesn't just apply to movies, but that kind of, people have talked about this for a long time, that middle ground has fallen out, right? Yeah. Like it's just an event movie or a big giant movie, or you'll wait for it for the most part, right?
Or they're just being made for streaming services, right?
Yeah.
Because like even before, like again, I'm using Black Book as an example because it's recent, but
Black Bag, yeah.
Black Bag, sorry, Black Book is the Paul Verhoeven movie. Black Bag is a great example because Soderbergh, up until recently, you know, even working with David Koepp, Kimmy was an HBO or Max now streaming thing, and that was during
COVID and stuff, though, right?
But he was working within like streaming for a while. Logan Lucky was like the last kind of big theatrical film or traditional theatrical movie he had.
And now, High Flying Bird was Netflix.
And No Sudden Move and Let Them All Talk. Like they're all streaming movies, but these are also films that like 10, 15 years ago would be theatrical films because a lot of them have big name stars
Black Bag, right? Like it is that. It's a movie that is made 100 times in the 90s, but like.
But now it's become like a novelty, or it's like become like the one that escaped the compound.
And then people still go, well, I could wait for that probably, right?
And so like the next one of those is going, talking about Michael Fassbender with The Killer, like then the next one of those movies is probably going to end up being, if it gets made even, is just going to be dumped on a streaming service.
And then weirdly that feels lesser to certain people like me and you or something, right? Like it's not like we even consciously go, well, that's a streaming movie, it's less than. But for me, it's sometimes harder for me to go, that's like it, I don't know, it loses some of its importance in maybe subconsciously of me going, oh, I don't need to rush to watch that. And then sometimes it just passes me by, and then I need to be like, there's a lot of streaming movies that I've also missed, right? Or even movies I say, I'm like, I'll wait till streaming to watch that. And then they get to streaming and I just don't watch them, right? Like, unless someone says it's great. Unfortunately, we have access to so many things. Like, it's impossible to be bored, right? If anyone says you're bored,
you can be overwhelmed. I think that's
overwhelmed is, yeah, absolutely. I think that's the point I'm making, is like sometimes there's too many choices. You don't know if you want to watch a movie, watch a TV show, do an arts and craft, go on the computer, play a video game, watch sports, you know, go outside, touch grass, like all of this stuff. There's so much at our accessible to us, like again, where before you either had to go to a movie theater to watch something or go to a Blockbuster or a video store to rent something. It had to be intentional, right? Well, now we have more access to everything and there's more choice than ever before,
but then we don't watch as much because
it's not like an intentional thing, right? Like it's just like I sit there scrolling, or I don't know what the fuck to watch, or I put on YouTube videos, or like, and I've watched 20 hours of a Dungeons and Dragons show. It's great quality, it's good stuff, but like that's an easy watch to me, where I'm like, a movie I have to choose. And television I'm watching a lot more of, hence with the studio. And then there's this weird meta thing of it's about movies, but it's a TV show and it's filmic and it's,
but it's on streaming.
Yeah. It's funny, man. So yeah, it's, these are the inside baseball things. I think the show wants you to, the people who care about this stuff and talk about that stuff will really, really love the studio. And I think
Even if you don't, people will really like it. So it only gets better, in my opinion. There's a couple episodes there in the middle that maybe aren't as great, but like I still think that it's fairly consistent in being very, very, very good and very funny. So I can't wait for you all to see the rest of it. It's excellent. One of my favorite things in recent memory. So thank you all for listening. We really do appreciate it. Please go check out our other stuff we have up right now. We actually finally brought back The Cast of Us, our untitled HBO The Last of Us podcast, where Eric and I go through every episode of HBO's The Last of Us and recap the episode and talk about what happened and things like that. We were very consistent in that first season up until episode 8, and then I had a mental breakdown and we stopped doing it. I'm much better mentally now, as you guys know if you listen to this show and other things. So we decided with The Last of Us season 2 coming back in mid-April, we are going to return to that show. So we did episode 8, which is available for you to listen to right now. You can just search The Cast of Us or Untitled Cast of Us, and it should pop up in your podcast feed. We'd love for you to go subscribe to that. And then we'll be doing episode 9 next week. We'll have a review of season 2 of The Last of Us before season 2 comes out as well. And then we're going to try to do those week-to-week recaps. So a lot of good stuff.
Well, we've got Andor as well coming up.
Ooh, and Andor. We got a lot of TV, man. Like, there's, thank God for TV, because without Black Bag, Mickey 17, Looney Tunes, it was bleak for me. I haven't really seen much this year. So we're going to be doing a lot of TV stuff until...
How dare you? The Electric State is right there.
Yeah, it sure was.
I know we haven't talked about this, and I know we're wrapping up the episode, but I have never had to force myself to watch something.
Dude, I was hard, dude.
And I know you had an in, though, because you really love the book that it's based on. And that, I know that probably hurts even more, knowing that, like, oh, people are going to judge the book based on the movie they haven't read. Yeah. And watching it, you're just like, what?
$320 million.
What are they trying to accomplish here?
Just soulless.
I've just seen anything that is a waste.
Mm-hmm.
A waste of space.
It's pretty bad. I doubt we'll review The Electric State. There's just no reason
please
at this point. So
there's
nothing to say.
There's
nothing
depressing.
To say. Yeah. But if you want to check out everything else, please check out The Cast of Us, Untitled Movie Podcast. Go follow us on Letterboxd, which is Untitled_Movies. And you can follow both myself and Eric on all those social medias at Matt Rohrbeck and at EM6211 or Eric Marchand, depending on the platform. Please go watch The Studio and Apple TV, kind of crushing it. Go watch Shrinking. Go watch Severance.
Well, any Apple TV show that starts with S.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Okay. Bye, everybody.